Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Keith Lowe, author of Prisoners of History. What monuments to World War II tell us about our history and ourselves. Published in December of this waning year by St. Martin's Press. Keith has offered many works of history, mostly World War II, including Inferno, a study of the bombing of Hamburg in 1943. His second book was Savage Continent, a prize-winning study of Europe in the aftermath of World War II. The Fear and the Freedom continues in a sweeping and intimate history of what happened to all of us because of that war, the consequence of which still resonate, kind of like this book. Keith has written for The Times, The Wall Street Journal, and many other periodicals. So, Prisoners of History. First question, and a puzzling one, who are the prisoners and why some 75 years after World War II are there any? Second question, why are the answers to be found in the monuments left behind by that war and monuments that are, as we speak, still in the making or in the unmaking? What are we thinking, or who is it even, that is thinking when decisions are made to erect these massive, lofty, moving metaphors that fill us with reverence, honor, glory, despair, tragedy, and the weight of memory and loss? What are these symbols that we hold up as some type of representation of who we were, who we are, and who we might hope to be or not? So welcome, Keith, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, well, let's drill down a bit first. Well, actually, what I said about unmaking and what we were talking about before is this book comes out right in the middle of all over the world, but in America, us tearing down, we want to tear down statues of the guy who wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, Francis Scott Key, you know, or Woodrow Wilson, of all people. So when you talk a little bit about that, why don't you tell us why you decided to preface the book at this particular time with that comment?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, I think, you know, the book is called Prisoners of History. But in some ways, it's not really about history. It's about the present day. You know, it's... you know, we're all today prisoners of our history. We you know, these things happened in our past, but they're still affecting us today. And actually, I think these monuments, you know, they are about our history. Of course they are. They represent historical figures, historical symbols, but they're also about, you know, the values that we hold dear today. So, you know, when they were erected years ago, we held certain values, but our values as society change over time. And when those values have changed and the symbols aren't necessarily as relevant as they once were, or hold, you know, different meanings than they used to, that's when they start to become problematic. And, you know, we've seen this with statues devoted to symbols of slavery or colonialism or whatever. But it also applies to symbols of the Second World War. There are plenty of places all around Europe, for example, where old statues of war heroes have been torn down because they're no longer heroes. You know, we the people in those societies view them as monsters rather than heroes. So, you know, our values change over time. That's kind of the underlying message, I suppose.
Well, and I could go on about that, but we need to get into the book. So first, logistically, you chose World War II. So why, other than the fact that you're kind of obsessed with it, although in your TED talk, you said everybody else is.
Well, I'm no different. I have to admit that. It's a big part of my life and my history. So, yeah, I am obsessed with it.
Well, I can even see the books behind you, and I assume a good majority of them deal with the World War.
You got it.
So first, okay, so why World War II? Got it. Why monuments?
Right. Okay. Well, World War II, because it's, you know, we're living in a time now where suddenly we've got this whole sort of coronavirus thing, which is happening all over the world. It's a big global thing. Those events are rare. You know, what happens in one country is important to those people, but not necessarily to people in China or Indonesia. But the Second World War was something which affected everybody all over the world, even if they weren't involved in the fighting. So it's a point of our history that we all have in common. Although, as you will, you know, the more you read through the book, you realise that actually the way we look at that history is completely different, depending on which part of the world we're viewing it from. So that's the main reason why I chose the Second World War, because it's something we all understand. It's in all of our histories. The second part,
go ahead. Go ahead with the second part.
What was the second part of the question? Remind me.
Well, it's... And I can frame it so that we can get into the book proper. So the questions would be, one, why monuments? Second, which is, I know it's has to be partly arbitrary, is why 25? Why five categories? The categories are heroes, martyrs, villains, destruction, or apocalyptic things. And the last, rebirth. How did you frame that in your mind before you started the book? Because you must have.
That was a lot of thinking went in before I went anywhere near getting a pen. Monuments. The reason I chose monuments is because, you know, there's no such thing as nuance with a monument, really. I mean, some are more nuanced than others, but you've really got to boil down your sentiments into a single image with a monument. So why that image? Why does Britain choose a particular image to focus on and say, well, that's what our memory of the war is? Why does Germany have a completely different image? And so on. I chose these five categories because they, to me, are the sort of five categories of kind of mythological thinking we all have about the Second World War, which explain the different national perspectives on the memory of the war. So, you know, some people remember themselves as the heroes of the war, and you know, the USA and the UK are perfect examples of that. Others think of themselves more as the victims. You know, your French or your Poles or your Czechs, they think of themselves as the victims of the war. So their monuments have a very different angle on national memory. Then you have the monsters of the war, of course, who Germany certainly admit that they have a sort of monstrous past. Other countries who were also involved in the wrong side of the war are a little less honest about that, perhaps. Japan being one example, Italy being another good example. And then we have a sort of global view of the war as this sort of moment of, like, I don't know, kind of like an Armageddon, I suppose, where the old world was destroyed. And the atomic bomb is a perfect symbol of that. You know, it destroyed a whole way of thinking about war and replaced it with something new, a sort of rising from the ashes, a new world. So that's the fifth category, this sort of resurrection of the world after the Second World War. So those are the five categories of monuments I describe in the book. And they are, I think they're also the five categories that inform our own mythological thinking about what the Second World War means to us 75 years later.
And while I was reading the book, of course, I thought, as you encourage the reader to do, in my own mind, what are monuments? And I began to think of, like, intangible monuments, like, I won't get started on this, like, Trump is a monument to stupidity. I mean, it's an intangible thing, but it's still, in my mind, a kind of monument. And you see it in books all the time. This is a monument to the despair of love or something like that. But then I thought, semi-intangible, like the pile of shoes or all the watches in Hiroshima that have stopped at the exact time. And those, you imply, if not express, are monuments as well, even though they aren't these blocks of granite. So would you agree that those are monuments?
Yeah, I mean, I one of the points of the book is to try and expand our idea of what constitutes a monument. And those are, they're sort of informal monuments, but anything that holds a sort of powerful meaning for all of us can be considered a monument, I suppose. It's the symbolic value which makes something a monument. And the more people who see that symbolic value, the more potent and the more sort of monumental, I suppose you could say, that object is.
Well, so, all right, so we should get into the actual monuments themselves. And one of the ones, this happens to be the first, is the Mamayev Kurgan, Mother Russia. And one of the reasons why is because it's so gigantic.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about it, so our readers know the way in which you're proceeding through this book.
Okay. This is the famous monument of Mother Russia, which stands in what used to be the city of Stalingrad, but is today Volgograd. And at the time it was built in the 60s, it was the largest statue in the world. And it's sort of a picture of Mother Russia holding up a sword and beckoning to the soldiers behind her to come and fight for Mother Russia. And she is huge. I mean, the Soviets really went in for big monuments anyway, but she is really enormous. I took a photo while I was there of a man standing at the bottom of the plinth, and he is about the same size as her big toe. So you can see how vast this thing is, and pictures don't really do it justice. You know, standing underneath this thing, you can feel the weight of it above you. It's really impressive. It's sort of, whether you want it to or not, it hits you right there. You know, you this powerful, huge monument of stone and iron behind you. It's really quite it gets you, you know. So the whole point of her, though, is that she not only represents the war, which for Russia was bigger than it was for any of us. I mean, the death toll in the Soviet Union and Russia in particular was huge. And so you have the sort of weight of all that that painful history. But she's also representing Mother Russia herself. She's not only a symbol of the war, she's also a symbol of the power of that gigantic country. You know, come and fight for me. I'm huge and I will always protect you, is what she's actually saying, which is a message for the 1960s as much as it's ever a message about 1945.
Yeah, it's funny how some of the monuments are basically, I could use the obscenity, but I won't. Like the monument in Jersey City, you know, don't mess with us.
Yeah.
Or Mother Russia, like, okay, you know, you come here, you've got this, you know, almost with clenched fists. And some of them are clenched fists, like the peace statue, which was a great, that's the like the coolest one. But it's funny because when I was doing this, I liked the part where you actually talk about what the monuments look like, because, you know, I would take the Statue of Liberty and think about this and then realize that this is much, much bigger than the Statue of Liberty, which before COVID I would see every couple of weeks and thought was huge. This is double the size.
Yeah, yeah.
I kept worrying about her sword.
Well, the sword had to be replaced because they were really worried about it, the wind catching it and swaying the whole statue, and the whole thing could come tumbling down. So they had to stiffen it and replace it in the 70s, I think it was.
And drill holes in it like my shop teacher used to do when he spanked us, so that there wouldn't be air resistance as he came forward. There's so many of them, but because I'm American, the other statue monument that has burned itself through my retina and the convolutions of my brain is Iwo Jima, because it's just such an American icon. And especially, and you discussed this, the idea of a man reaching for it, but not being able to touch a flagpole like Browning. Should a man's reach should exceed his grasp or what's a heaven for?
Yeah, yeah.
Talk a little bit about that statue, which I thought was fake. I thought they reenacted it in order to take the picture.
Okay, yeah, well, the picture was taken, it was the second raising of the flag on Iwo Jima. The first one, the photographer wasn't there. It wasn't faked. I mean, it was, they did send up another bigger flag.
Gutters. Protect gutters.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, so the it wasn't entirely fake. They did send another flag up, to which was bigger, to be unfurled up there, and a photographer went with them, and took that famous image of the flag being raised. But the whole point of that image is not, again, the reason why it's so important in the American imagination is not because it's about World War II. It's not because it's about the Marines. It's because they're reaching for the flag. You know, the flag is the whole point of the monument. And that, like you said, you know, it's the reaching, the hands reaching up towards the flag. It reminded me of that image of the Sistine Chapel with, you know, God and man, their fingers almost touching, but not quite. You know, it's man reaching for a higher cause. And the higher cause here is the flag, the American flag.
Yeah, I know. And it's funny how you talk about when you go someplace, even though you might end up, and I don't mean to say trashing, but kind of trashing a monument. But even when you go there, like you said in your TED talk, you have these feelings, you know, of nationalism, of pride, mm-hmm. or you cry, but then you have this little thing in your head, which I do too, which I always do. I always have this commentator in my head, but this little thing that says, you know, am I feeling, is this right? What about all the people who die who aren't being commemorated here?
Yeah.
And that's true.
That's the thing. Monuments are interesting, not only for what they say, but for what they don't say. You know, for the things that have been left out, that's what's interesting as well. And, you know, in my TED talk, I talked about the Bomber Command Memorial in London. You know, that is about the British heroes flying the bombers to, you know, to help win the war. You know, aren't they wonderful heroes? And the answer is yes, they are wonderful heroes. But on the other hand, there's another side of the story which is not being told there, which is pretty horrific. And, you know, 500,000 civilian deaths caused by those bombers is not something to be just brushed over. No matter how necessary it was, it's still something that should have been properly acknowledged in that monument, but which isn't.
Yeah, it's funny because so many of the monuments, I'm jumping all around, but so many of the monuments are still being built. This is what was 2012, something like that, that they built?
Yes, yeah.
And part of me is going, okay, get over it. You know, and yet what you're saying is not, sometimes it's not really about the war. It's about something else. And like what you said, because in reading Churchill, he's always like gone, you know, okay, yeah, the Americans came in 1942, really, we had already pretty much staved off the Germans. It's us. It's we who did this, not the Americans. And he's pretty pissed about it, actually.
Well, those feelings are still there today. If you scratch the surface in Britain, you know, you see the reviews of, I don't know, Saving Private Ryan or something.
Yeah.
D-Day was all, you know, it was all about the Americans. What about the British and the Canadians who are also landing on the other beach? You know, you can find these emotions still today. People get riled up about these things.
When you talk about, like, say, some of the Japanese monument, and you kind of, and the reviews say it, you know, you kind of eviscerate some of them almost. Do you get tweets and emails that kind of say, how dare you?
Yeah, all the time.
Really?
You know, this is the thing. You these are these are symbols which hold huge emotion for people. And if you start questioning some of the motives behind a symbol like that, there are going to be people always who are going to be angry at the fact that you're questioning something. You know, I just think we should question everything. This book is called Prisoners of History, right? Not Prisoners of Memory. And we all remember things in different ways. But if you're a historian, you have to try and look not just at the sort of the easy symbolism of it, but also the other not so easy stories, which are the nuances which are being left out by a monument in this case. But it could be a text. It could be a story of a particular individual. As a historian, you have to question everything, and it's healthy to question everything. That doesn't mean I don't feel the same emotions that everybody else does. It just means that I'm trying to also weigh up some of the other stuff which is also going on.
Well, since you do have this somewhat outside commentator, you know, I thought throughout, you know, Henry Ford saying history is bunk, or the other saying history is written by the winners. So do you feel like you have an inherent bias when you write all these works? Can you not help having a bias?
I don't think anyone can help having a bias. I mean, the trick is to try and recognize your own biases and try and sort of mitigate them a little. And if you can't do that, then at least admit to the reader what your biases are. So, I mean, in my last book, for example, Fear and the Freedom, there was a chapter there on Brexit. Now, as a British person, you have to take one side or the other. There's no sitting on the fence. It's impossible. So I had to declare myself in that chapter, which is doesn't sit easily. You know, as a historian, you like to sort of stand above it all like some, you know, impartial figure. And if you can't be impartial, you have to insert yourself into the chapter and say, hang on a sec, you should just know this about me before I continue.
Yeah, it's I think, you know, how they say a sign of intelligence is holding two competing ideas in your head at the same time. I think also this ability, as I said, the third time I've said it, this ability to stand outside yourself and see what you are doing gives you such a leg up in writing, because some people can't do that. You know, they just.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that's where the emails come from. You know, people who are pissed off, and it's because they are so deeply involved in those emotions that they, you know, might not be in the rest of their lives, but in that particular moment, they are unable to step outside those emotions. So they, you know, they type off their anger and press the send button, and I read it here in my office, sometimes with a chuckle and sometimes with a bit of shock.
Or fear.
Yeah. Oh. I usually just, they're pretty harmless, I think, but, you know.
Yeah, they worry me, and even in my bookstore. Oh, in my bookstore, I put up a Black Lives Matter sign. And I got all these emails and tweets and Yelp reviews, which really hurt, that say, you know, I came by your store to buy tons of books, but once I saw that sign, I will never patronize your establishment again. And I'm thinking, why would it, to me, being naive, I'm thinking, well, why would they say something like that? It just went out of my mind. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah. It's not a rational response, but you know, we're emotional human beings, and it's just what happens.
It's funny because you think of when the Americans entered World War II and when the war ended, it's less time than the Trump administration.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I mean, the thing is though that you know, the builders of monuments are counting on these. They're trying to evoke emotions when they put these things up. It's something that they're trying to produce a feeling in us. That's the whole point of monuments. And you know, you mentioned earlier that you know, there are new monuments being built all the time. The best example is Putin, who's been building monuments left, right and centre for the last 10, 15 years. And they are all monuments to the Second World War, because that's the last time that, you know, you sort of make Russia great again, is basically what he's saying. You know, remembering the past when the USSR was a major force in the world. Let's bring that back to, let's imagine ourselves as Russia the Great once more. That's what he's doing. He's trying to create a feeling of Russian greatness in his people to try and unify them under his leadership. And then it's got nothing to do with the Second World War at all, really.
Yeah, and I realized when I read it that it wasn't arbitrary you divide it into five categories, because there really are. I don't know if there's any more, but those really are five. And one, again, because I'm an American, is MacArthur coming ashore. And, you know, when you look at, and I compare that to the actual photographs, and it's really rather close. And that was one I wondered about, because it's the most human in some ways, but it's also one of the most, I don't know, metaphysical in some way, because it doesn't really show anything except somebody walking ashore with a resolute expression on a square jaw.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. He's walking through the, you know, this is the famous MacArthur returning to the Philippines. You know, he said, "I shall return." And this is the moment when he is arriving on the shores of Leyte. And there was a famous photograph that was taken at the time of him wading through the waves to get to the shore. And so this monument they reproduced the photograph, basically, of him and the five guys behind him stepping through the waves. But the way it sort of rendered is almost like, you know, you can see MacArthur, it looks like he's walking on water, you know, he becomes a sort of Christ-like figure coming to resurrect the Philippines and save them from you know, the evil which has engulfed them over the previous few years. So there's a real sort of religious significance in that way. But, you know, if you're going to put your faith in a religious figure, MacArthur is not necessarily the person you would choose, because he was a very flawed individual indeed. So,
yes, but then when he did return, his speech of returning was basically a Christian, you know,
absolutely
about Christ, and maybe equating himself to Christ.
It's quite, you know, if you were, I mean, there's something almost blasphemous about the way he equates himself to the sort of the Almighty coming to save the Philippines. You know, it's quite something.
Like, hearken unto me. Yeah, exactly. But then again, the opposite of that, at least to me, and the most lovely of all the statues is the peace statue that faces directly to the Japanese embassy, much like the little girl looking resolutely in Wall Street at the bull. And the same kind of expression. Talk a little bit about that statue, because it's, to me, it's the most objective, yet it honestly is the most effective to me. Mm.
Okay, this is a statue of essentially it's a sex slave during the Second World War. The Japanese imprisoned lots of Korean women, in fact, women from all over Southeast Asia and China. And made them work in military brothels. This didn't really come out. I mean, it was kind of known about, but nobody talked about it until the late 1980s and early 90s. And at that point, it became suddenly a huge story in Korea. And lots of former sex slaves began demonstrating outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul. To say, you know, come, what you did to us was horrendous and you need to apologize. And the response by the Japanese has been a sort of to-ing and fro-ing. You know, on one hand, they apologize, and then, you know, with the next breath, there's been a sort of rescinding of that apology, and then they apologize again. And it's all very sort of, you know, on the one hand, but on the other. There's no unequivocal apology. And so this has festered for years and years. And these women have continued to demonstrate every Wednesday outside the Japanese embassy. And on the occasion of the 1,000th anniversary, some artists built this peace statue of a girl sitting in a chair facing the Japanese embassy, her eyes sort of fixed on the embassy. And she has an empty chair sitting next to her. It's like an invitation for someone to come and sit down and there'd be a kind of dialogue. So it's kind of a beautiful thing, really. However, there's also a sort of slightly darker side to it. I mean, it's an accusation. It's an accusation directed at the Japanese embassy. And as you can imagine, Japanese officials are not too happy about this. This every time they walk out of the door, that's what they see, an accusation. So it's become a real problem diplomatically between South Korea and Japan. Still is today.
But the thing about this statue, and I didn't even notice it till you said it, is the idea of the clenched, semi-clenched fists at her waist. But it's not the thing that's I find lovely about it is the accusation is at best implied. It's just this look that says, a resolute look saying, yes, this was done to me, but here I am still. Here I am. So when you walk out your door, here I am.
Yeah, it's quite moving. It's this statue's been reproduced in lots of places all around Korea, but also in other parts. I think there's one in San Francisco, for example. Lots of places have reproduced this statue because it's a really powerful. I mean, her face is quite neutral, actually. There's no sort of anger there. She's not sort of directing anything really angry, but it's still powerful anyway. It's difficult to explain. There's something there you can't help noticing.
I thought about that when I read the book. I wondered, have you visited all of these?
I've visited most of them, yeah. There were one or two which I didn't get to, which, you know, are very well known. So for example, let me think. I didn't get to the Katyn Memorial in New Jersey. I think that's pretty much the only one. Just looking down the list. I went to all the others.
Quite a lot of traveling and research.
It's a lot of I mean, you know, this is my job anyway. I go around the world researching stuff. So every time I go to another country, I always make a point of visiting the memorials because I find them so moving, you know, and really interesting. They sum up so much in such a small sort of a concentrated way. So every time I go abroad, I always take in the statues and the monuments.
And the one in Jersey, not that one. The one in Budapest is like the opposite of the peace statue. And also it's all wrong.
Yeah.
But talk about that, the difference between the eagle and his nastiness and this semi-saint with the orb. Talk about that statue. Because I was there and I didn't understand. What are all these people doing out front, handing out these pamphlets and seeming to hate what they're in front of? And until I read your book, I had, what the heck are they doing? I don't understand this. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, that's amazing. It caused a big stir at the time it was put up, which again was only recently. I think it was 2014.
Yeah.
It's a statue in Budapest of it's called the Monument to the Victims of the German Occupation. And it portrays Hungary as this sort of, well, as the angel Gabriel, which is a sort of symbol of Hungary anyway. But, you know, Hungary was no angel during the war, I have to say that. So you've got the angel Gabriel standing there and he's holding up in one hand an orb, which is another symbol of Hungary. And behind him, there's this eagle swooping down to grab hold of the orb from his hands. And of course, the eagle represents Germany. You've got this evil thing coming to attack the saint and steal his sovereignty. Now, historically, this is all wrong. I mean, this did happen, but, you know, for most of the war, Hungary was an ally of Germany. So, and they were involved in all the atrocities. They were on the Eastern Front. They were involved in the Holocaust and so on. So people in Budapest were really angry that this statue was being put up. Without any consultation, by the way. It was just put up. It was a government plan with only a handful of people coming up with the idea. And so they gathered together and they demonstrated in front of this thing, even before it was put up. And they decided they were going to set up their own monument, which they called a living memorial, which is very moving, actually. It involves ordinary people have brought mementos of their families who, you know, died during the war or who were victims of the regime in one way or another. There are photos of Holocaust survivors. There are testimonies from them. Old suitcases that people used to carry their belongings to the concentration camps. And these have been set up as a sort of display in front of the official monument. So you have these two things sort of having a dialogue with one another, the official and slightly dodgy monument, and then this unofficial and quite beautiful, heartfelt, living memorial that stands in front of it.
I like the way that you said the poor Gabriel, he's holding the orb carelessly, you know, not thinking that the eagle's about to swoop down and take it from him. It's almost as if he's so innocent that he doesn't even think that something like this could happen. And it's such a lie.
I think that the statue himself has got his eyes closed, you know, so he's really not paying attention.
And his poor wing. I mean, who thinks of these things? And then you have a statue that is a representation of essentially nothing. It's basically two cement blocks. And if I was there, I would just walk by it thinking it was, I don't know, the beginning of a building or something like that. Talk about that and why it's supposed to be so nondescript that you don't even notice that it's there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is a monument that I was involved in right from the start. I was invited by the Slovenian government to come and witness the unveiling of the design just when it was still at the architectural stage. It's a monument in the capital of Slovenia, Ljubljana, which is supposed to be a monument to all of the victims of the war. It's very difficult to know who the victims are because, you know, on the one side you've got the sort of fascist collaborators who were involved with the Germans and the Italians and helped to massacre Jews and so on. You know, not a nice group of people. And on the other hand, you've got the victorious partisans who won over them, who are Tito's communists, who after the Second World War took all the collaborators they could find and massacred them and threw them into mass graves in you know, down mine shafts and so on. So you, the other side's not very nice either. So who do you commemorate? You know, do you commemorate the victims of fascism or the victims of communism or, you know, the poor guy in between? It doesn't really get a look in. So they created this sort of nondescript monument in order to not really offend anyone. And because it doesn't offend anyone, it doesn't really say anything. So nobody likes this. People walk past it, like you said, not really knowing what it's about or even noticing it's there, really. Which is, you know, there was an emotional need for some kind of monument, but this was all they could agree on because it's such a difficult issue in Slovenian history.
And there was two striking things in that particular chapter, particular monument. One, like you said, you were there, and it's kind of humorous, but everyone you met wasn't really comfortable, didn't even want to talk about it with you, and you couldn't figure out why are they not. And then your friend takes you to where the monument actually should be.
Yeah.
This gate that's locked, and then talk about what you saw, because it's horrific.
Yeah, I mean, I this Slovenian historian, his name is Mitja Ferenc. Great guy. He was involved in some of the exhumations of these mass graves that were, laid dormant from 1945 all the way through to this century. Because, these were the people who were killed by Tito's partisans after the war is supposed to be over. So this is like June, July 1945. All these collaborators and so on who've been massacred. I went along with this guy to one of these mass graves. He took me into this mine. We walked about, 400 meters down through this tunnel into the darkness of this this place. He made me climb down this mine shaft and stand at the bottom of it. And then he called down to me, "There are 1,500 people buried under your feet. We pulled 430 corpses out of here, and they're in another room somewhere further along. And this is where they died." And I'm standing there at the bottom of this mine shaft, thinking, I don't know this guy that well. He could turn the lights off and leave me here. So I quickly climbed back up the ladder. And but then he took me into the place where they stored all these bones, and it was really, really shocking. Nobody wanted to do anything with them because they didn't want to make a shrine to these people. They had, after all, been fascists. But they had also been victims, they'd been murdered. So they didn't really know what to do. So they just chucked all their bones into these plastic crates. And these crates were just lined up along the tunnel wall on these sort of makeshift metal shelves, just sort of going moldy. I mean, it was quite disgusting. And the politicians had just sort of locked the door and walked away and were sort of pretending it wasn't there. I have to say that actually since then they have finally found a sort of ossuary and put these things away somewhere properly. But for years it really wasn't talked about because it's just too uncomfortable.
And there were two things that struck me. One, the official who finally said, well, yeah, this was the easiest way, basically, to get rid of to get political stability. So rather than try and mess around with things, we just decided we'll kill them.
Yeah. Well, you end the war, and you're the victorious partisans. You've got all these collaborators in your midst. What can you do? You can spend a lot of time and effort trying them, and which is what the Americans did in Germany and the British as well. They didn't have the resources for that. They also didn't really have the political will, because it's difficult to do something like that. So the easy thing to do was just line them up and shoot them. Problem solved. So that's what they did.
And then the true monument to me, and you explained it very well, although you also again say, well, he was a fascist, is the guy who found the piece of steel and tried his hardest, almost heroically, to get out.
Yeah. Yeah, that's as I'm walking in this tunnel towards where all these people have been killed. There was a sort of hollow in the tunnel wall, and Mitya stopped and he said, when we exhumed this place, this is where we found the first body here. 100 meters away from the mass grave, and this was a guy who had survived. He'd crawled out of the mass grave after the partisans had gone, but they'd sealed the tunnel up. So he'd ripped up a piece of metal from the railway track in there and was using it to dig his way out. But he came up against a concrete barrier that had been put there, and he just couldn't get any further. So that was where he died. And so when they came 70 years later, that's where they found the first body. And I don't know. It's so difficult to know how to feel about this guy because, on the one hand, it's quite heroic. He survived a massacre. He's trying to dig his way out. That's something amazing. And so he's a kind of a hero, but he's also quite probably also a perpetrator because he is himself a fascist. He's also a victim. There are lots of layers of meaning with this one guy trying to dig his way out, which make him impossible to categorize, really.
It's funny because, again, well, there's lots of juxtapositions in this book. But one, well, first of all, I'm Jewish, so I also am a hero. Not a hero. Shoot, that was a Freudian slip. I am a victim. I'm a prisoner, and I think that, and it's not because I'm Jewish, but I think the most effective monument is the monument in Israel, because you walk us through it. It takes you on a trip.
Yeah.
And the other ones don't.
Yeah, that's a, talking the museum in Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, which, I mean, this was part of my trying to expand our idea of what constitutes a monument, because, you know, in a way, it's not a monument, it's a museum. And actually, the bit I'm talking about mostly in the book is the balcony at the end.
Yeah.
So as you go into this museum, you are taken on this journey, which it's the way it's built is a long sort of prism shape, triangular prism. And you as you enter the museum, you can see the other end where there's a kind of light at the end of the tunnel. But you can't get there. You've got to go through the museum first. And that zigzags back and forth across this main thoroughfare. And you can't go straight down it. You have to go back and forth. And it takes you on this journey through the Holocaust, through the initial sort of, Kristallnacht and so on. And then the point where the Jews start getting rounded up and put into concentration camps. And then the killing, Auschwitz, Treblinka. And finally, after going through all that, and it gets darker and darker, not only in the history, but also physically darker. You, as you're walking through, it gets more claustrophobic. And finally, you come out at the end and you walk out into this light, and you can step out onto this balcony. And you're in the light and you have a view of the Jerusalem hills in front of you. And it's such a relief. And the whole message behind this is that this light at the end of the tunnel, this the whole journey through this horrible history is taking you to the promised land, which is kind of the gift to Judaism. The sort of reward for having gone through all that horror, if you like. Which is sort of a dodgy message. I mean, I can see the point of it, but it's also politically quite a sensitive thing, which has to be acknowledged as well. That this wasn't this gift of the Jerusalem hills. There were other people who lived there at the time and who didn't want necessarily to be giving this gift. So it's a political thing, as well as a trip through your history.
Yeah, it resonates in America right now very strongly, as anti-Semitism does rear its head. And what do they call it? Dog whistles, actually.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing about that, the Palestinians were there. And I don't know how I feel about that. I honestly don't. I honestly don't know how I feel about that.
And so you shouldn't. This isn't it's not a simple issue. There are no simple answers here. And I mean, the thing you say about dog whistles, I think the important thing is not to say that I have the answer. It's to say that there's lots of questions, and let's not turn our faces away from those questions. We have to acknowledge them. As long as they're acknowledged, it doesn't mean that, the answer we've chosen as a world is wrong. Or that there was, it might be the best answer we can come up with, but trying to pretend that there aren't problems, that is itself problematic.
And the other aspect of that, and I'm going to get to this now, is I read this book recently and interviewed the author. I've forgotten the title. He's a Israeli historian of Auschwitz and the Holocaust. And he's constantly taking trips and bringing Israeli students to Auschwitz, like everyone goes to Auschwitz, and giving them the tour. And some of his students, much to his dismay, although he's a reluctant convert to this position, some of his students say, we need to be like the Nazis. We need to have this strength of will. And he's appalled at first by these students who feel like this is the way we need to be. with regard to our own nation. And you talk about that there is this certain feeling of strength, of will. But so talk a little bit about Auschwitz and the fact that what bothered me was like the tours now seem to resonate the same way as getting out of the boxcar and being pushed around quickly. And you talk about, what has it become? Is it like the theme park of atrocity?
It's a really tough one. I mean, I don't envy the people, the organizers of the Auschwitz Memorial, because you know, they have so many visitors, and it's great that they have visitors. You know, I really think the feeling you get as you walk through that place, especially when, for me, there's two sites, right? There's one which is the original Auschwitz site, which is where they have a museum, but then there's the other, the main camp where they kept most of the Jews, and had the gas chambers and so on, which is about a few miles down the road. And you know, just seeing the scale of what happened there, again, you can't really do it justice with pictures, or when you're there and you can see it in front of you, how big it was. It's really shocking. So getting visitors there to experience this and show them what happened is really important. But on the other hand, when you have 5-6 million people coming each year, you know, if you're going to show them all the things which are in the museum, they have to be got through quickly. So you're put on a kind of conveyor belt, really, and you go through on a tour with your group, and there's another tour sort of 2 seconds behind you. So you're ushered through the stages of the camp and the Holocaust, and there's something machine-like about it, which has very uncomfortable resonances, considering the machine-like quality of the death machine that was there. You know, it's very difficult to know how to process that while you're also having these difficult memories and feelings about the history of what actually went on there.
It reminds me of what Eric Idle said is the best one-liner he ever heard, when the Germans invited Monty Python to go to Germany because they said, we don't have a sense of humor, and we want you to teach us. And they took a tour to Auschwitz, and it was past closing time, and they said, you can't come in. We can't let you in. And Graham Chapman just said, tell them we're Jewish. But yes, you talked about it as being an assembly line, and so there were two assembly lines, and now there's another one. Yeah, it's very disconcerting.
But again, you know, what's the way around that? You know, there isn't really. Yeah, exactly.
Well, like you said, people having picnics, and I read another story about a woman being upset because it was too crowded, and you know, we didn't get to see all of Auschwitz. Like, okay, yeah, I understand, but this is not. It's not supposed to be something pleasant or something you have to see like a ride in Disney World or get a fast pass or something like that.
Yeah. But I mean, it's one of the sort of sites in the sort of must see sites in Europe now, along with the Uffizi and the Colosseum, and let's go to Auschwitz next. You know, it's kind of, there's something really quite uncomfortable about that.
It's probably the pivotal point in the book where the discomfort, I mean, and we can't go to every monument because we'd be going on for hours, but because you talk about the Japanese monument and you talk about the monument to Mussolini, which is, I had no idea, and it scares the hell out of me. But I think it's the pivotal point because it is the most disquieting. It's the most disquieting. And also, it's not like any of your other monuments. It's big. It's a building. Yeah. It's a really big place. All it is a really big place where a lot of stuff happened.
And
so it's like, again, it made me think, okay, is it fair for you to limit these monuments to these blocks of granite and stone and bronze? Or are there other monuments? I mean, silly monuments like the Arch in St. Louis, or the Golden Gate Bridge, or I don't know, something as far-fetched as Elon Musk with SpaceX and having this super heavy rocket. Is that a monument to America's ingenuity? Is that a monument? You know, it's how far do you stretch the word?
Yeah, yeah. That is a good point. Yeah, how far do you stretch the word? I mean, it's a monument for one person might not be a monument for someone else. But it's like I said, you know, it's the amount of emotional energy which is invested in it, which makes it a monument. I mean, there was a French academic called Pierre Nora, who came up with a sort of way of categorizing these things. He called them lieux de mémoire, you know, the places of memory. Think anything which sort of holds memory within it. So it could be a person, it could be a site, it could be an object or a monument. If they hold memory within them, then they are kind of a monument in their own right, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. And the other thing you say is, or someone said, is that the bigger the event, the bigger the monument.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, you know, but not always the case. I mean, you know, that monument at Stalingrad of this gigantic woman, I mean, that is appropriate. What happened there was huge. And so they built a huge monument. But then there are other places. I really wanted to put this in the book, but I couldn't find a right space for it. There's a monument in Brazil to the Brazilian troops who fought in the Second World War. And they were there, you know, they did take part, but there was only like 2,000 of them or something. And yet the monument in Brazil is huge. Like there was some, you know, magnificent, gigantic expeditionary force who saved the world, you know. that's kind of funny. And I didn't quite know how to put that in, but I do regret that, because it is there's a point to be made there.
Well, it's like the one which doesn't fit into your category, the one in India now. I think it's Sandra Patel, one of the founders of modern India. The Statue of Unity, it's 600 feet tall, and it's just this guy, and I'm thinking 600 feet tall, that's And it's the biggest monument in the world now. I know yours were the biggest at one time, but why? What? Yeah, that's a good question. Why?
Well, you know, that's again, this is another sort of grandiose. You know, what they're trying to say is, you know, Indian independence was a big deal, and it requires a big gesture to explain it, but. You know, that particular monument is to a Hindu guy. It's a Hindu nationalist government who's created it. It's an expression of political power, which is invested in one portion of the population. So, you know, that there's a very political meaning to that, which is potentially a little bit aggressive towards the people who aren't part of the Hindu nationalist party, for example. So, you know, the contemporary meanings of that are much more important than the historical ones, I think.
Yeah, and that divides your book as well. I mean, yes, prisoners of history, but as you said, with Putin and with other statues, again, I had no idea that these are still being built, is that a lot of them are politically motivated and really have nothing to do with what happened. They have something to do with how can I manipulate what happened to assist me in my current regime.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, so that really, to me, doesn't represent the fact that 75 years ago this momentous event occurred. It represents something not good, something evil, something corrupt. And you touch upon it, but is this what it's going to be now? I mean, is every monument that's going to be, I mean, why are, I mean, like I said, three quarters of a century, get, you know, I don't mean it this way, but it's like I said, get over it. And
but I do want to point out that it's not only the you know, the kind of today's bad guys, if you like, who are trying to manipulate their nations into supporting them. Monuments of all kinds are there. They're manipulative by nature. So even the monuments to peace are trying to manipulate us into feeling peaceful thoughts towards one another. You know, I would argue that's in a good cause, but it's still kind of manipulative. So, you know, I think it's the final one in the book, actually, is not an object at all, but actually a hiking trail, which has lots of objects along the way which you can visit. But it's the trail from Normandy to Berlin, which the Allies took in 1944 and 1945. And it's been created by a group which is affiliated to the sort of the European Union. The Council of Europe gave it funding and so on. And it's there to try to drive a vision of Europe as one thing. You know, Europe was liberated as a whole by the British and the Americans. And now look at it today. It's one whole again. We're all one big happy family, the European Union. That's the message that it's giving, which is a political message. Just because I happen to agree with that message, you know, that doesn't mean that it's not manipulative. I've got to acknowledge that it's a manipulative thing.
Yeah, and then, not that it directly deals with monuments, but in watching your TED talk and looking at the pictures, you have the one that struck me were the two newspapers that showed Angela Merkel doing this, or actually dressed in a Nazi uniform. Does that have anything to do with what we're talking about?
Well, you know, it's just picking an easy symbol to try and cast Germany as the perpetual villain. Angela Merkel's got nothing to do with Nazis, but she's the head of state, and it's an easy target. So quite a few newspapers have done that, and magazines have taken a picture of her and photoshopped a Nazi uniform on her, and you know, made out that Germany's the bad guy, which historically they were. And it's just a way of, you know, tugging on our emotions to try and get us to do something.
It's like what I saw this morning. Just this morning was one of the newspapers that every year has a comment on Queen Elizabeth's Christmas speech. And this year they did a deep fake of her making the speech, just like they do with Obama. And that's something that as a historian has to drive you crazy, because pretty soon we will have no idea whether what we're seeing is what is the truth, even though we have an idea now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's getting more and more of a problem, especially when, you know, videos can now be manipulated. So we used to be able to believe our eyes, and now you have to investigate everything before you can believe it. It's tiring.
You talk about American movies, the thousands of American John Wayne type, again, square jawed movies, which are totally manipulated, in like a Nicholas Sparks book or a Thomas Kincaid painting. They are designed to make you go down a particular path where you will feel a particular way. You have no choice. I'll cry when I see the movie The Notebook. I cry. I can't help it. And that's what it's designed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what monuments are designed to do, too.
My point.
They're there to make us feel an emotion. And if you just take that emotion at face value, well, you know, fair enough. Go for it. But if you want to look behind those emotions and try and see what else is there, there's an interesting and much richer story to be told underlying these things. That's what I'm trying to do in the book.
Well, okay. Well, then essentially we've been talking for well over an hour, and I can't do all the monuments, even though I would, but kind of. And well, first of all, the book in our bookstore does focus in great amount on nonfiction books, so it's right out on the front table with other books about racial matters that are very current in the United States and other books about World War II. But it's like, what in fiction, some people like books that are tied up tightly at the end, you know what happened. Other people like books that I wonder what happens to this person next. What am I as the reader supposed to think? What can I do to not end this, but where is this going? So what are we, the reader, in your book? What is our work to do at the end of it? Is it closed? Okay, these are the monuments. This is what I wrote about. Done. Or are we just, in your mind, do you have a task for the reader?
Ah, that's an interesting question. I mean, I suppose my task is something I think, which is very difficult to do in our everyday lives, which is just to try and stop and think. I mean, it's hard work, right? You know, it's much easier just to go through life just living it without having to think too much about everything. But these are emotional things, and these are important things, and they say a lot about who we are, not only as a nation, but as a world. You know, these are globally recognized symbols. And I just want us to stop occasionally and just have a little bit more thought about some of the underlying stories which lie beneath the surface. You don't have to go into it in a huge amount of detail, but just stop for a couple of minutes each time you come across one of these symbols and try and acknowledge some of the other things which are going on. Try and notice a bit more about what's happening and notice the heartstrings, your own heartstrings that are being tugged, and maybe ask yourself why they're being tugged in that particular way. You can come to your own conclusions about what those reasons would be, but I just want you to just take a look every now and then.
Yeah, and I don't want to be self-righteous about either you or I, but the thing about it is, whether it's abortion or gun control or the death penalty, what I try to do, because everything is polarized in America, is listen to both sides. There are merits to both sides. And I think by listening, you can unpolarize and you don't necessarily make the decision, but at least you have a dialogue.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, we have it here in the UK too. I have friends on one side of the political spectrum who will refuse to talk to other people. You know, where's that going to lead? Why are you refusing to talk? They're normal human beings just like you. Yeah, they're not monsters. And yeah, that's a lot more of that, you know.
Yeah, and that's the one thing I've learned from traveling, and you have too. People pretty much, and I think you even say in the book, people pretty much are the same everywhere. It's the governments that aren't. But people pretty much, you know, people in America will say, well, Paris, the French are really rude, and, you know, you don't want to go there because they're such rude people. But, yeah, they are theoretically rude if you speak to them in English, expect them to know what you're speaking. And then if they don't know, an American raises his voice and says it again louder, then assuming that they'll understand. And so, yes, that's why it appears that they're rude, but it's totally in their head. But enough, because I end up going off about me rather than you. But it's been a pleasure talking to you. I loved your book. At the very beginning, I thought, well, this is just not going to be, it's just monuments. I don't understand. And then as you move into it, you realize there's this incredible narrative. And what you did in the 25 monuments and the chapters and the concepts behind each of those five sets really made a lot of sense and made the book really come alive. So I really appreciate you writing it and also appreciating you talking to me today.
Well, thank you. Thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll talk again soon when your next book comes out.
Yeah, hopefully. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. So long.
Bye.